Whenever feasible, one should always try to eat the root. Would you join me at the table?
Welcome to Eat the Rootcast, a podcast about NBC's Hannibal and the works of Thomas Harris. I'm Cooper, and I have with me...
Hey, it's Miko.
And this is Ophelia.
And tonight we are talking about roti. Roti, right?
I believe so.
It's the O with the little hat on it.
But yes.
That's just... And it's directed by Guillermo Navarro, who directed the Angel episode and the Totem Pole episode. Written by Scott Numerfro, Steve Lightfoot, and Brian Fuller. So we have three of my favorite Hannibal writers on this episode. Scott Numerfro wrote Coquille, which is the Angel episode, and Steve Lightfoot just shows up on so many episodes, starting with Trow Normand. So no killer of the week this episode, unless you want to consider Abel Gideon a killer of the week.
Considering what he does...
Mm-hmm.
Is he taking the mantle?
Yeah, but it's sort of like on the flip side. You know, mm-hmm. rather than starting with it, we get a tableau at the end.
Yeah.
So it's a little different. But you still somewhat get a killer of the week.
Yeah.
He's just the killer of the every couple of weeks.
Every couple of weeks.
I really like that we open with Hannibal and Chilton having dinner.
Oh, yes.
Because, you know, in the last episode we talked about how Chilton is like poor man's Hannibal.
Yes.
Who is not nearly as good at being Hannibal Lecter as Hannibal Lecter is. I like that Chilton's really trying to keep up with Hannibal's witty repartee here at dinner. And he mentions it feels like a
Last Supper.
Mm-hmm.
yes.
But Hannibal says you poke around in a psychopath's mind and you get poked back.
Mm-hmm.
Which is nice.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
You wonder if Hannibal's self-aware enough to realize that Will could poke back.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure.
But I think he thinks he's so much better.
He does.
At the game.
He can handle it. It's interesting because he's also talking about Chilton's place in Gideon's.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Sort of. And it's fascinating, too, because basically they're talking about Gideon is not who he thinks he is, because the person who he thinks he is actually the person who was hosting this dinner.
Right. Exactly.
Right. So, but yeah. Little does Chilton know.
But Chilton
know.
Doesn't know. So
Chilton does not know.
Yeah, there is like a tangled web here.
It would be so interesting if Chilton was that smart.
Yes.
Yeah.
But he's not.
Well, Chilton is really backpedaling too, you know. Like he's in major defensive mode. And he's in major defensive mode because Gideon's going to get transferred to give testimony.
Yeah.
Because he's suing Chilton, which is interesting. Yeah. I didn't know people could sue from inside institutions. I didn't know that was a thing.
I guess so.
But I like the double meaning behind when they talk about once a patient is exposed to the method of manipulation, is then that much harder to continue the manipulation.
He particularly says the subject must not be aware of any influence. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know they're talking about, there was a term that they used, and I can't remember what they used now. I should have written it down. For what Chilton did to Gideon, they use a specific term.
Oh, it's the psychic driving?
Psychic driving.
And that's pretty much what he's talking about, but it's kind of funny to hear, because you know it's kind of what he's doing to Will.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, so...
Exactly what he's doing.
To have him, you know, basically saying, well, you can't have the subject know.
Right.
That you're in for.
And we're constantly watching Hannibal covering.
Well, it's another one of those moments with Hannibal where he's just like, you know, if it were me, I'd be cool, you know.
Right.
You don't have to worry about me.
Right.
I'm totally on board with your manipulations. It's cool.
And I'd do it better.
Yeah. Well, yes, absolutely. Let me tell you how to do this.
Right.
Because you got caught, you fool.
Exactly.
Well, it does sound like Chilton is asking for his advice.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's, well, what would you do?
Because Chilton desperately respects Hannibal.
Yes.
Like, he looks up to him. He is exactly what Chilton wants desperately to be.
Yes.
Yeah. And then once we talk about the patient being exposed to manipulation, we cut to Will.
We snap.
Which is another one of those great cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
do you suppose the glacier footage was shot for it? Or do you suppose that is...
Oh, I think that's stock footage.
Stock footage.
I believe that's stock footage. Because those glaciers are constantly being monitored.
Mm.
It may be unreleased scientific videography.
Right. But that was beautiful, wasn't it? The shot across the water with all the shards of ice floating there, and then those pieces falling off. Then we find ourselves on the beach with the totem pole again.
And the tsunami.
And a tsunami,
which is
one of those reoccurring sort of nightmare. It's one of those dreams that so many people have, the wave off in the distance that's coming to swallow him. And Will is basically, you know, Will's feverish, and so he's sweaty all the time.
And
that sweatiness, you know, when
he feels wet.
When you're feverish and you're sweaty, you will have fever dreams of water.
Of water.
And Will is dreaming of water like crazy.
Everywhere.
And so, you know, last episode he talks about where he's not sure if he's awake. He's not sure if he's dreaming.
Mm-hmm.
And so he awakens from this dream of the tsunami crashing down to his clock, which then melts.
Melts into
water. Which I thought was beautiful.
Wasn't that great?
It becomes water.
And did you notice Will was steaming?
Yes.
When the water touched him?
Yes, because
steam was coming off of him. Mm-hmm. But really interesting is the fact that it was 8:19 in his dream when the clock started to melt.
Mm-hmm.
When he woke up, it was also 8:19, which means he was in one of those states, like sort of asleep, sort of awake. Mm-hmm. He was awake enough to know the time, but still asleep enough to be dreaming.
I thought it was also interesting the way he becomes the water.
The water is filling up around him, and then all of a sudden he just became water.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
we've been talking about how it's possible the show is showing us things that are from Will's perspective that aren't necessarily actually happening. So we can't really pick apart the details of
Will has become the unreliable
tableaus.
Narrator of the show.
Right. But I feel like this is one of the turning points for me. Like what's going to come in the future.
And the big things are really revealed in these sort of vision-like dreams.
Yes, because there's more.
Right.
This is where the show starts to do that more often, where it is artful and it is figurative, and they're throwing a lot of you know, interpret this.
Right.
Like, I'm going to throw something out there that is, you know, just beautiful to watch. Yeah. Like, to have that film, to have that body turning into water, that is an art form.
Mm-hmm.
And they start to throw those in more frequently.
More frequently.
And I feel like
hallucinates more.
That seems to be where it started. Because I don't think we've seen anything quite like that where you have something that, you know, completely
this is
turns
one,
into
probably
something
one of the most elaborate of the dreams, because normally it's either him in the woods or him. Things are kind of natural, and supernatural or unusual things will crop in, but not something like where changed into water.
Right.
It's usually he has sort of a surreal experience, and then he'll experience some buddy that's one of the dead victims or something like that, or another person will come in.
It seems so much more of a literal hallucination.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, but also at the same time, you know, it'd be so easy for a show like this to, they've already talked about how Will's mind is on fire.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been so easy for them to take us in that direction and have him dreaming of fire
being
hot.
Instead, we took us in a different
direction. We go into
direction.
Water, and then you have to wonder about that, because water is something that can be all-encompassing. Water can consume you. And he sees the totem pole, which we have talked about as a resume.
Mm-hmm.
It is representative of a body of work. And so Will can feel this oncoming wave, this thing you can't stop
something
or do anything about. It's coming to consume him, his work, the other things he's working on. And it's just all over the place with that.
It's kind of interesting that the show is using these dreams, not only Will's brain trying to tell him something, but it's them trying to tell us something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a great device.
And they're parceling out the future. They're parceling out the subtext of the show, and they're letting us interpret it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a brave show that does something like that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like I really do feel that the dream sequence that it was at the end of episode 2 of Twin Peaks had no code to break. They parceled it out once they figured out, oh, now we can do this. But I do feel like these dream sequences have a lot of weight to them and have been planned out. Maybe not at the beginning, because, I mean, the director of the first episode, David Slade, has talked about how when they were making that, they weren't sure what the Raven Stag was. It was this interesting thing and this interesting combination of the elements that we've seen thus far. And I really like that the show takes things in the dream logic where if you've seen six things today, you might combine four of them into one thing in a dream.
Right.
And we see that a lot in Will's dreams. He's picking up elements from the world around him, and that's what he's dreaming about. But then you also have to wonder, are they dreams or are they hallucinations?
Right.
Was him waking up and seeing the clock a dream? Was it a hallucination that is being brought on by the encephalitis?
That's true.
I mean, his doctor is dead.
Was he still dreaming, or was it a nightmare that then turned into a hallucination when he woke up? Because there is a moment where it's real until you see that clock.
And the text waterfall. Just melts off. It's just, it slides down. Yeah.
Yes.
That was so nice. Cool. It just literally becomes a waterfall of the clock.
And the water's rising up around the bed, and then he's laying in the water, and then he just pops, becomes water.
Yeah, let's go ahead and continue with Will's visions, because I think that there's a lot of that in this episode.
Very much.
The next one I want to talk about is when he is watching Jack do the traditional presentation to the FBI.
What you always see him doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
then there's a what Will calls a thicket of antlers.
Yes.
And
that continues to grow.
It does. And Jack is saying these things. Institutionalized at Baltimore State Hospital, armed and dangerous, and then that yelling at him, that what kind of crazy are you?
Yeah.
Which isn't something Jack has said. It's something Will has said that now he's applying to Jack. And that's
And you will kill again.
Yeah.
After he says, what kind of crazy are you?
He says, you will kill again.
You will kill again.
When what was great about that sequence is, you know, we've seen so many of these fantasy / dream sequences in the dark, and that was in a very brightly lit room, and then they were surrounded by white antlers. So it was bright, that room.
And to have Jack sort of, you know, framed and seen through these antlers made him very surreal. And then because you had the antlers in focus in the foreground, and then Jack, you know, in focus in the background, but then they would shift it. It almost looked like a collage, because there was all the pictures, all the images that he was using while he was doing the lecture. You know how Will will have, you know, the PowerPoint presentation of all the images. And sort of like there were bits and pieces of that, and the antlers were coming out of the of all these images that were sort of on the wall. So when you saw Jack, I thought it looked like a collage of all the murderers, and then Jack in the background, and then all of the stag, the antlers, as if they were pieced together, like bits and pieces of things sort of glued on top of each other.
Will also has a moment in the lab where the drawers
autopsy
behind him
drawers.
start leaking water. And he tries to ground himself, like he closes his eyes and he's like, you know,
he's like,
this
that's
is
not
there.
Happening. That's not
and
water.
It goes.
Yeah. It's not real.
Just really.
But he's literally like
sweaty.
Vibrating.
Yeah.
You know, with this conscious effort to keep it together. And he is just drenched with sweat.
And Jack notices that when he's up against the wall in the thicket of antlers.
And he's anger served again.
Yes, you go back from what Will's seeing to what Jack is actually seeing. Because you keep getting this difference of perspective. You see what Will sees up against the wall. And then you see what, you know, Jack is looking at Will. And you see from a realistic perspective.
And Will's just over there looking really shifty and
he's
nervous.
And
Jack is
and sweaty.
Jack is, he's got it on his face. He's like, okay, this is way out of control
Something really awful is going on now.
So with Gideon transferring for testimony, Yes. There's this little witty, this back and forth where Gideon's just besting Chilton all over the place.
Oh, yeah.
And it's so nice to see Eddie Izzard back because he's so good.
Oh, he is amazing.
Just plays it so nicely.
I love his banter in the van.
Yes. Oh, he sits there and he was like, he just goes, Married?
You married?
Yeah. Married?
Just married?
Yeah, you're married.
Have you noticed that he uses his entire face when he talks? Like, he doesn't just open his mouth. His entire jaw is all... Yeah, he's so interesting to watch pronounce words.
Yes.
You know, he's really just getting in there and chewing on the word. And, you know, it's the kind of performance that could easily tip into camp.
True.
But I think he's riding the line. He's recognizing that this character's campy. This character is Anthony Hopkins' Hannibal Lecter.
It is.
You know, and this escape is very Anthony Hopkins' Hannibal Lecter.
Every bit of it.
You know, especially the moment where we see Will break his thumb.
Own thumb. Yeah.
But I mean, what's great is you conflate these two things. So we don't see Gideon do this stuff.
Nope.
But when we see Will do it and think back upon it, you can see Gideon doing these things.
Right.
Yes. I also like the leap when we were talking
about... When he's waving.
I am seriously like an animal.
That
was very creepy. Yeah.
Before we get there, my favorite moment from the opening was, how do you keep those whites so clean?
Yeah.
And then all you see is the blood on the linen.
Yes.
The blood.
And then we go
through
to the opening credits.
Yeah. So we don't even see what that's in reference to. We're like, okay, so there's some white scrubs with some blood
You know what it is.
You do know.
Because he's sitting there looking at... And he's already berated him. Because when he asks the guy, you know, married, and he gives the whole long thing about,
I recommend you kill them all.
Just kill them all. Yeah, don't
kill everyone at the table.
Yeah. And then he goes, some people are not meant to be married. And he does a little shift over to the guy.
Yeah.
You know, like us. Yeah, like him.
We're not meant to be in relationships.
Not meant to be in relationships.
We're the same, you and I.
And, you know, then he goes into the, you know, how do you keep those whites so well? And you know, the minute he says that, it's like,
That kind of delivery takes me back to Dan Aykroyd. You want to see something really,
really scary?
From the Twilight Zone movie.
and it was, because you saw the very surreal close-up of the fabric.
Yes.
Yeah.
And just the edge of his the collar part of it and the stitching, and slowly the blood bleeds through and
flowers outwards. Did you notice that, so we get that back-to-back with the title sequence, and the title sequence, which I've always assumed is on white, is definitely not on white. It's on this sickly pale yellow. And you don't notice it until it's put against something that's white. And these linens are white. So we get linens drawing the bloodiness into them. And then we go into the wine blood title sequence. And it's lovely.
It was a wonderful segue. Because you have sort of the same thing. You have the blood sort of coating and spreading. And you do sort of the similar thing with the opening title. So it blended into each other really well. Yeah, and then, you know, when you're going to get back from the credits, everybody's going to be dead.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
And you get Will doing the pendulum.
The pendulum stopping.
Yes, okay,
yes,
good.
We all noticed.
And you see the linens in the pendulum.
Did you notice it? I did.
Yeah, pendulum swing stops midway. You see a flash of the linens, and then we're into the flashback. And maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I saw.
No, I have to go back.
I made a note.
I just remember it stopped.
Yeah.
Halfway,
which is something we haven't
seen
before.
Right in the center.
No, it's almost like Will's gauge is broken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Will's gauge just broke halfway through midstream. Mm-hmm.
And then he's very aggressive in this scene, and you wonder how much of it is actually Gideon and how much of it is...
Is Will. Yeah,
right. Was it really that
just
that
like
violent?
That
especially
violent.
The cuff throat cut.
Yeah, that was pretty brutal. Everything that he did.
But the leaping on the driver, you're right. Just poised and ready.
Like an animal. Yeah. And then he does that leap, and it's like a quick cut.
Like, to them, we're out.
Yeah.
You know, and we see the organs hanging from the trees. And we get a nice little moment with Price and Zeller here, which he even tied little bows with
Zeller
is all really impressed. It's pretty impressive.
I mean, not only that, but knowing what I know about anatomy, to find the veins that are going to support hanging an organ from a tree, it's going to take some time and some digging. Because those veins aren't superficial veins and arteries. You're going to have to go deep from the femoral artery, you know, the ones that they would use.
And they were pretty long, stringy arteries.
You got to like that you impressed the lab geeks with the kill. Yeah. And it's also a matter of the show basically saying, okay, it's incredibly unlikely that this killer could do this. We're impressed.
And we're impressed, exactly, because this is, like, way out there.
How about Abel Gideon is having a difference of opinion about who he is?
Yes, I liked that one.
And I think it's interesting because you do get the sense, I mean, Abel Gideon is unhinged. He has this appearance of being in control, but he's unhinged because he is very confused about who he actually is. So he's got this thing where he's killing like another killer that he doesn't think he is, but he might be. And if he isn't, maybe killing like him will draw out the other killer, which will prove who he is or is not. So it's this really complicated dance he's doing, while at the same time just being really angry.
Well, you know, it complicated his life, but it also, I think, I don't think he mentions it in this scene, but it's later on when they have the whole argument about, you know, like, why were you convinced that you were the Chesapeake killer? At what point did you realize it wasn't you? And basically, he says, well, what was great about it was that he got to tell people that he was the Chesapeake killer. So there was sort of the combination of him not only sort of not knowing that that was him and embracing it, but it was easy to embrace because it was a lot cooler than the guy that just lost his shit on his family.
And killed his whole family at dinner.
Which is a little bit sadder and sort of more loser-ish compared to, wow, I could be that guy. Mm-hmm. Or I could be this even cooler guy, you know, who has his stuff together and does, like, amazing stuff. He enjoyed saying that.
Yeah.
And then when he found out that he wasn't, it took away this ability to sort of step into the shoes of being a lot cooler killer than he actually was. Yeah. And that disappointment was about as crushing as anything could be to him. Mm-hmm. You know, it crushed his ego. It's like, I can't tell everybody I'm this really cool killer anymore, and I hate you because of it.
Yeah, it's all your fault, and now I'm going to Colombian necktie you.
Yeah, exactly.
Where Chilton's little control over his situation is rapidly crumbling.
Oh, and he's just, completely.
He's so desperate in that scene with where Will and Alana come to visit him. And he's just like, well, maybe you did it. I don't know. Maybe you told him. Oh, maybe it's your fault.
He's backpedaling like crazy.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because he already tries to, trying to put the blame all on Alana.
Yeah.
And the whole thing, maybe it was you manipulating him, but he was manipulating you, and you two were like, you were manipulating each other, and it had nothing to do with me.
Right.
I'm out.
This is not me.
Maybe he's going to eat you.
I don't know. Oh, and I love how he's sort of like a mewling baby in this episode. He knows he's so screwed.
And he totally lies about the last thing Abel Gideon says to him.
Yes.
But it's an interesting
that he's going to tell the world, right?
Yes.
That
he's going to tell everybody that he's the Chesapeake Griffin,
which is interesting because why lie about that?
Yeah. I know,
and that's the mark of desperation. You're so desperate, you're just going to lie. It's just like, oh well, yes, no, maybe I don't know. Maybe he is the Chesapeake River. Who knows?
Who knows?
Yeah, it was a little comical because he's bouncing around all over the place.
That's why I like Chilton.
Right? Yeah. Oh, yeah, he's out of control in that scene. He's so, like, emotionally on the edge and backpedaling.
And nervous.
And accusing everybody. And, yeah.
It was funny, the interesting... So Will's falling apart here, and you see Alana flare up in anger about, well, how did you feel, or how did you sleep with your nurse?
When the nurse was, and then he blames her.
He blames her for, how are you going to feel when all of the, new victims of Evil Gideon, and... Mm. It's like this moment where she lunges and Will just kind of like grabs her shoulder.
Well, yeah, Will is actually very lucid in this sequence.
Of all the people, that was really interesting that she was like, she was like going to leap over the desk.
No, it's not worth it, Alana. It's not worth it.
It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. Like, what? Really?
The man who is unhinged together just long enough.
Falling apart.
Yeah.
He understands that even then, Dr. Chilton is not worth it.
I thought that was interesting.
Let's talk about the antlers that are behind Will in Chilton's office.
Yes, okay. that was a great
find. We rewound it to see again. We don't see much of them. I'm not sure if we see them in another scene or if they were there the whole time, but it's interesting again. The similarities between Chilton and Hannibal. Hannibal has the entire elk in his office.
Right, he's got
Chilton's got some antlers.
There was a. It was like a photo. It was like a picture or an illustration of, wasn't it?
No,
or,
I think it was actual physical antlers. Statue. Yeah.
Because there was a head. And
there was a picture behind it, and then
it was in front of a glass picture.
Yeah, but it is kind of funny that they both have. A stag in their office. We were talking about Will having the hallucination in the briefing. And one thing that I wrote down is the heartbeat. Yeah. And that's something I think in a lot of his backtracking and a lot of his hallucinations in this one, very heavy heartbeat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He describes it to Hannibal. When they're discussing
this is the scene where he's talking about the thicket of antlers. Mm-hmm. That hallucination.
Yeah, he describes it to Hannibal, the thicket, and the sound of his own heartbeat, but he said muffled as though... How did he describe it?
Like footsteps fleeing into silence.
Into silence.
The thing that stood out to me was that he's gradually becoming different. Mm-hmm. And, we're all very sensitive to the trigger word becoming in Thomas Harris' work. Yes. Mm-hmm. And he talks about he fears not knowing who he is, which is a callback again to Georgia Machen from the last episode, who isn't sure who she is, if she's alive or not. And Will isn't sure who he is. And Gideon isn't sure who he is. Mm-hmm. So it's, again, one of those richly connected episodes where all of the things are working together.
Exactly. I also thought another thing was interesting about that what was a big trigger for him in that was that Jack kept saying hospitalized at the Baltimore.
Yeah, because Will is terrified that that's where he will wind up under the care of Dr. Frederick Chilton.
Exactly.
And he says, too, because he doesn't want to go inside, this is several episodes earlier.
This is the first time we meet Chilton, when he talks about being afraid that he'll be left there.
Right. And, I forgot what Jack said, but he basically...
He said something about not today.
Well, he said not today. But it was kind of like, don't worry, I'm here.
Yeah.
I'm not going to leave you in there, no matter what they say to me today about your condition.
Today was the important part there. Yeah.
And then we have, right around this time, the discussion with Abel Gideon feeling like Will, crazy, not knowing who he is. And Hannibal saying that he's going to find the Chesapeake Ripper. To be his gauge.
To gauge who he is.
Of who he is. Mm-hmm. And then telling Will, don't worry, I'm your gauge, Will.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm your
gauge. Isn't that comforting to know that Hannibal is your gauge?
Gauge.
I was much more comforted by Jack being bedrock.
Right. Yeah.
Hannibal being the gauge of who you are, I'm a little unsettled there. And I think Will, at this point, has started to question the... the strength of Hannibal being his bedrock.
Yeah.
But he also is going to doubt everything he's questioning during the
He's doubting absolutely everything in this episode.
Yeah. Well, I think one other really interesting thing that they said in that conversation between Will and Hannibal, where we had the like footsteps into silence, and he keeps going on, I feel like I'm, you know, somebody else. I feel like I'm crazy. I feel like I don't know who I am. Then he starts talking about Gideon, and he mentions that it's like a blind man.
Oh yeah, that's
and,
right.
And it's like someone got into his head and moved the furniture
around.
That was a great way of describing it.
And that recalls Reba from Red Dragon and her ability to walk around once she gets oriented. Yeah, that rich thematicness. Rich.
There was so much going on in that conversation. Well,
and then in the lab, they talk about how he didn't remove any of the brain because he performed lobotomies on these guards, but he didn't remove any of the brain. He just scrambled them.
Yeah,
because that's which is how he feels.
Yeah, which is what has been done. So it's nice because the show can give us these little morsels, and they don't have to say, you know why he did this.
Right.
Because we get it.
Yeah, and it happens show naturally in the dialogue and in what's going on, exactly. Because they're using it as two devices of how to prove that it's not the Chesapeake Ripper. Where they're like, well, we kind of know it's not him, because if it was him, he would have done this. And he wouldn't have scrambled the brains. He wouldn't. The organs would have been. It would have been different. They would have been. Wouldn't have been removed and put in a tableau, because that's not what he does. But then it also is presenting us with a metaphor for how things are. This is where we're going. Mm-hmm. You know, he's removing the organs and scrambling. And even Will just says it. Well, that's because he feels what was done to him.
Right. And now Lana later says Gideon can't be completely responsible for his actions if he was subjected to an outside influence.
Mm-hmm. And then she worries that she's to blame.
Yeah, well...
So inadvertently, not like as if she had intended to, but she's worried that she inadvertently
She reinforced it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Chilton may have wound him up and pointed him in this direction, but she came in and confirmed, yes, you apparently you're this guy.
This guy.
And he's like, yeah, I'm that guy, totally, yeah. I was surprised that I felt strongly about a moment that is Will and Alana relationship-y.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
Where Will says, you don't need protective custody to cozy up with my dogs.
Well, because she says that, you know, she's going to have protective custody. And
she asks if Will is it.
And if Will is it, exactly. Yeah. Because, you know, we could, you know, then I could cozy up. It would be nice to cozy up, you know, with the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't say specifically him.
Right.
She
says
it would be nice to cozy up, you know, with your dogs. And then he kind of says, well, you don't have to do that to cozy, or for me for that matter.
And it's a lucid Will moment.
It is a lucid.
You know, it's a lucid, genuine moment there. And it's really nice.
It seems like he's genuinely, like, he's very conflicted and hurt by the fact that he can't provide more stability.
Yes.
Because it's not, before it was, okay, she wants more stability out of Will. Mm-hmm. But right now, Will needs more Will stability.
Right.
Like, Will's
it's
like...
It's not just a lot.
All right, I would really like to have some moments where I'm not hallucinating shit. Can that please be
for
my reality?
For a change. For a change. And maybe the next doctor I go see doesn't have his head chopped off.
Right. Exactly.
That would be great.
And also the stress of realizing that you're being kept from a relationship you want to be in because you can't keep yourself together.
Yeah.
That it's not something that you can change. You can't go, oh, she's not with me because I don't have a job or I don't know how to control what comes out of my mouth because I'm an idiot, you know.
I'm going to go out and get sane for you.
Right, yeah. Something he really can't work on. He can't sit there and go, okay, well, maybe if I... you know, was nicer or more considerate, or if I was more responsible, things that are easy to fix. Okay, I'm going to work on getting a better job.
Yeah.
I'm going to work on being more supportive as a partner. I'm going to work on maybe not being as angry. Like, things that can actually physically be worked on. His sanity is something he cannot change right now.
And he's normally in control of this. And he... you know, is used to having this weird way of looking at the world, which some people might call insanity. And he's had that his whole life. And it's only up until now that he's lost control of keeping that under wraps, it in his, you know, kind of in his pocket, so not a whole lot of people see it. Now it's just bleeding out all over the place, and he can't shove it back in fast enough, and he's starting to, what?
Your visuals are interesting. The bleeding all over the place,
shoving it back in.
I mean, really, you've got the linens, and you've got our we'll discuss it later. Chilton holding his entrails.
Yes.
Oh, sorry, that's just what I was thinking about.
That's just where you go.
It reminds me of a story that I read in high school with Flowers for Algernon. It's something he can't change. Mm-hmm. It's his. He's a nice guy, but he's not intelligent, and he knows he's not intelligent, and Will knows he's not stable, and knows that he can't be that person to provide for her, but wants to be in this relationship so desperately. And it's sad in the book because it shows the perspective of the doctor, the scientist, who's also wanting that relationship to be real, but knows that
there's no way
it can't be.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting sort of dynamic, or, you know, like relationship-y thing that you feel.
First part that doesn't feel like network notes in Will and Alana's relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It feels like a genuine thing that comes organically from our characters and isn't just there because, oh, by the way, we should have a relationship here.
Right.
Right. It's not
filler. And that's really nice because they sidestepped it nicely by hitting us with, we're not having a relationship.
Right.
So now we can have a little bit of longing. We can have the mourning a relationship that couldn't be.
Gives you a device.
Well,
that
yes,
is,
okay.
You know, we've all had, we all know those shows where there's...
The Will They, Won't They.
Will They, Won't They.
So Alana and Will are still, the Ross and Rachel of this.
They're still keeping that going, in the show. And that's kind of what I see whenever they have their, they don't have them very often, thank God. And thankfully, it doesn't seem forced.
Right.
But that is a device to keep people going, because there are people who will just watch the show.
Yeah.
Because someday they may get together.
Two crazy kids.
They will.
Can't they just make it work?
They're gonna persevere, and then there's gonna be that episode where it's all gonna work.
Alana asks Will if she thinks they're going to kill Abel Gideon.
Because he's probably a shoot on sight.
Right.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially after what he did with the guard and the nurse.
Oh, absolutely. He's a shoot on sight, America's most wanted, top number one FBI list right now, because he poses the largest threat to who they think is going to kill next. They know he's going to. She's asking Will, like, what do you think they're going to do? Are they going to try to capture him? And she's feeling this horrible guilt and responsibility that Abel Gideon's going to die, because I feel like she knows he's a bad guy. He killed his family. Okay. But she also pretty much knows he's not the Chesapeake Ripper, because she has inside knowledge about the case, I'm sure. She's been consulted on it. She knows that the Chesapeake Ripper doesn't kill that way. And
the guilt that she's feeling is that that he's going to be killed for all the wrong reasons.
Right, right, because he's not that guy.
Right,
He was manipulated.
In the hospital and just being that guy that killed his family.
Right,
and
the loserish killer,
exactly.
Like you were saying before. The loserish killer deserves to have psychological treatment and, well, I mean, this is in Alana's mind, being treated for whatever it was that he snapped that one day, anger issues, whatever. But instead, he's been driven to this more vicious and violent killer who's got a higher profile, therefore will be killed on sight.
On sight.
And I feel like she maybe empathizes a little bit with some of these killers, that maybe doesn't believe that they deserve the death penalty. Mm. Like,
Well, I think Alana is definitely someone who believes in the
rehabilitation.
Power of rehabilitation and the power of good psychological counseling.
Mm. Right, driving you in the other direction. Right.
Not psychic driving, but...
Right, yes, into the you can
because she does not get on board with that.
Somehow no. Contributing to society, you were a doctor, maybe there's some way we could rehabilitate you to the point where you could continue to contribute something of value.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it's descended so far into madness that he's just going to be shot, and she feels like there was something she could have done.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow she should have caught this threat, this oncoming threat, mm-hmm. that he was being driven to lie or whatever mm-hmm. it was that she could have possibly undone. Mm-hmm. Mm. From the other people who are influencing him, or even his own delusions that she somehow just should have been more powerful to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she's experiencing the good side of what you should be feeling in this type of situation, whereas Chilton is completely going to the let's blame everybody and not feel at all responsible. Well, Alana's taking on the responsibility of perhaps all the psychologists and psychiatrists who have worked with Gideon
really
over this
did
time.
Him wrong.
And she's feeling it personally.
Mm-hmm.
Because she also she admits to Will that she had said to Abel Gideon that maybe you are not in the right mindset to know who you are.
Yeah, so she allowed for the possibility.
She allowed for the possibility of Abel Gideon to start questioning who he was, which she thinks is why he had this massive escape.
Sort of the snap. Yeah. And I think also what's hard for her is that she's not only worried about that he's set up to be killed by law enforcement, you know, by the FBI or the local police or whoever it is that finds him. Mm-hmm. She also is worried that the Ripper is also, you know, going.
Nice.
Yeah, who's going to find him first? Mm-hmm. You know, and they even bring that up. It's like if Dr. Gideon is afraid of the Chesapeake Ripper, like is he afraid? It's like, well, you know, the Ripper would kill him.
Oh yeah,
mm-hmm. Because he took credit for his work.
Mm-hmm. And he would consider that rude.
So speaking of rude, Freddie Lowndes.
Why
does she still exist?
Freddie's back. But Freddie actually has utility in this episode.
She does.
So it's irritating. Yes, I liked.
She's a pawn.
I like the way Gideon plays her on the phone.
Oh,
I collaborate. He knows.
He knows exactly what
I felt like for a second. She knew it was Abel.
If she did, I could see her going whether she knew or not.
Well, because there's a story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she does try to manipulate her way around him a little bit.
Even when she was trying to talk her way out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
She was like, I'll tell your story. Uh-huh. I'll tell them anything.
Freddie immediately went into Freddie Lowndes mode.
That's how she gets out of everything. Mm-hmm. I'll either lie about you, mm-hmm. and that's how I'm going to get you to do what I want you to do, because mm-hmm. I'll tell everybody I will lie about you, or I will get you to do what I want you to do because I will lie for you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What about that lovely moment? I'm using the term lovely a lot about bloody things. The moment of the blood being taken, where you see it going through the tube.
Yes.
It's these details that they are willing to dwell on and make beautiful, these horrifying things
The
show...
They make it even more
treats
horrifying.
So beautifully. Right. And then of course, we get to see... So last week, we had the Glasgow Smile.
Yes.
Which is a mafia kill.
Mafia kill. Mm.
This week, we have the Columbia necktie.
Yes.
Which is a mafia kill.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like they went on the Wikipedia page for gruesome executions. It's like, this is a good one.
How to die while telling a message.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Message death. Like, exactly.
Like, okay, we don't like you blabbing or being a snitch, mm-hmm. so we're going to pull your tongue through your neck.
Yeah. And how about the movement
yes,
on the
it was
tongue.
Moving.
Yes, the little bit
but
of
yes, that made it even more
involuntary
gruesome.
Muscle reaction.
Well, it's that they wanted to let you know
he's
as if the blood was not enough.
Still alive.
You had to see the tongue moving.
But, you know, Gideon is thoughtful. Because he wants the blood to be sent to the Red Cross.
Yes.
He does.
Because, you know, that would be a shame for that to go to waste.
That was hilarious. Because, I mean, it is such a gruesome tableau.
Yeah.
And that was, and I said how it's that the our killer of the week is done, you know, like on the flip side.
Yeah.
Where rather than having it in the cold opening, we experience it here. We get a live tableau, basically, with the sort of horrifically glib
Dr. With the killer. Gideon. With the killer hanging out. We don't see that
in the background, like, oh, how
Eddie Izzard
is
so perfect.
Especially
when he explains it to her. Yes. She's just kind of standing there in frozen terror.
Yeah, and he's like sort of like in these like stroking it, like, oh yes, you know, and this is what happens to the and this is how we do it, and he's touching the it's so horrifically gruesome. And then they're gone. It's replaced with
The team
finding it, and they're like, "Well, he's been completely bled. You know, where is the blood?" And that's when they open up. And there's the lovely note. You know,
To donate.
Did you find the killer, the victim with the mouse to be a bit whorish and cliche? Like, it's like the victim pointing at the killer.
Look.
If Hannibal had left this, it would have been far more subtle, because Hannibal trusts the FBI to get the subtlety. Yeah. Maybe Gideon doesn't quite know.
Well, because that's the thing, is Gideon is trying to sort of paint with the same, you know, in the same style, but there's a difference being, you know, the true artist that can be delicate, and he's just sort of like slapping things, you know, on the canvas. And he is, and a lot of it is just, I think, you know, with all this that's happening, I believe Will says it's like flowers and chocolate on a first date.
Yeah. He's communicating with the Ripper.
It's like Dollaride was sending love letters to Hannibal. It's that same type of killers in this world have these weird relationship vibes between them.
So in this thing, I think the whole thing, too, of leading it with the... And he's telling the FBI that he's telling the killer.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's sort of like, I'm taking this to the next level, you know, so keep up.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, and, you know, we were talking about how Freddie was playing her little game with Gideon, and Eddie Izzard just knocks her down with, "Miss Lowndes, I may be somewhat fuzzy in this area, but there's no need to patronize me."
Oh, yes. When she says, "But I thought you were the..."
Thought you were the Chesapeake Ripper.
And then she actually recants it. She's like, "Oh, I'm sorry." Yeah. Like, she knows she was being a smartass.
Exactly.
It's like, don't be a smartass with the guy here in the room.
With the killer, with the gun and the knife and the skills to kill you in seconds. Mm-hmm. Don't mess with me. I'm not in the mood today.
Yeah. But it is interesting that we are back in the observatory.
Yes.
Yes.
Which is really a gorgeous set.
Oh, it is.
Mm-hmm. And I'm happy when we go back to that observatory. We wind up with another psychologist on the slab with the Columbia necktie. This one missing an arm.
Yes.
And Will knows right away, this is the Chesapeake Ripper.
Yes.
And he is pointing us at Gideon. Mm-hmm.
And now... this is the Chesapeake Ripper pointing to Jack and communicating to Jack.
Yes.
Where was the last time
Where
you
was
saw
the last
a severed
time
arm,
we,
yes. Jack?
Now, the question is how Hannibal knew they were at the observatory.
I believe we did see
Hannibal reading the iPad article, because I like that Hannibal sits at his desk in the dark and reads Freddie Lowndes' article.
I believe Freddie released something from within the observatory to lead Hannibal.
But why wouldn't the FBI also be led to that specifically? If there was something that was obvious enough for Hannibal to see it, why wouldn't the FBI also see it?
I don't know. That is,
it's
that
just
is, that's
a little,
a good question.
It's a little logic
it's
bump.
It's a hiccup.
Right.
It's not enough to derail me on this really wonderful episode.
Yeah,
but it is.
We could probably analyze a way that the FBI wouldn't know.
I bet it's, well, I bet you're right. It's a Freddie Lowndes. It's probably a picture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what leads it to it. But I do feel like if Hannibal has the time to do another Columbian necktie thing and do this whole tableau specifically to then tell the FBI,
where
by the way,
at.
when he could just be there like, hey, isn't that that place where you found Miriam Lass's arm? Because I was there.
Yeah, oh, that's right. That's
That's that place, right?
Yeah.
And then Jack's like, oh, thanks, Hannibal.
Thanks.
You're such an awesome member of the team. What would we do without you?
But then we wouldn't have this wonderfully ghoulish...
No, I agree. Yeah. It's just
it's an opportunity to do something, you know.
Like, oh, this wasn't Abel Gideon. This was the Chesapeake Ripper. And he's communicating.
It's gilding
with you.
The lily. Mm. You know, they didn't need it. They're already doing exceptionally.
Right.
They're pushing themselves for that last bit.
They did a little bit more right here. Just a little bit more.
But here's exceptional. Mm-hmm. Gideon operating on Chilton.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
And the fear.
Wow.
The fear in Freddy's face, the fear on Chilton's face.
When they went into that, I thought that was going to be enough. That I'm like, okay. Oh, and I thought that maybe that the FBI would show up and we weren't going to go there. We were going to just scare the crap out of everybody for a little while. We're going to have SWAT team show up. And nope. Just like the end of the previous episode, we got a show.
Oh, man.
Oh, boy, did we get a show.
So Freddy is responsible for Chilton being kept alive.
Yes.
Which is an amazing thing here.
If the respirator goes off.
When Gideon talks about how it's good to have local anesthetic instead of full anesthetic, because it reminds him that this is a person, not a lump of meat I'm about to reorganize.
Yeah.
And I love the way, I mean, Eddie Izzard is, again, a very physical actor, and the way he performs with his hands in here, he's holding them up as though they're sterilized, but he's not wearing gloves, so it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And then he's just thinking, and he does these things like he touches his face, and he's almost this flourish movement with his hands.
Oh, that's amazing! What the body can.
Many organs the body can lose before? Yeah,
yes.
Before it starts to panic.
And we had some real operation footage in there, because. That was definitely real body in the when they go inside and you see.
Yeah, they took some.
That was
some,
real
they took
operation.
Some organs out. We got to see some intestines.
Unsettling.
And, like I said, every bit of this was amazingly just graphic and in your face. He is doing it, and you get to see the open abdomen. You get to see things, you know, being pulled out.
Yeah.
And he's working around it, and you get to see the agony. Sort of the you know, he's sort of not quite there, Chilton.
Yeah.
And when Chilton goes out, when he's shown his liver, it a kidney?
It was a kidney.
It was a kidney.
The first brightly...
Oh, that's right, it was small.
Burgundy, that's a kidney.
That's a kidney.
It looks like a kidney.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because you can lose one
so
of those.
So, let's go sidebar here.
Okay.
Sidebar.
Dr. Frederick Chilton. Just had a horrendous surgery in this episode. Near death. Yep. How does that feel for a first-time viewer who just read the books? Dr. Frederick Chilton is very much alive.
Yes.
In the books. And a very important part of Red
Dragon
and Silence of the Lambs. So what do you feel in here?
Well, they don't end his story here.
That's true.
You know, they
basically... But, I mean, like... In the moment, I'm talking about right here.
Because
the surgery is happening.
It looks like he's gonna die.
And Gideon is pissed off.
You know, because as I've said before, they're using a menu out of these books.
Yes.
We're not going to see every character all the way through. Not every character that comes and goes exactly the way they do in all of Thomas Harris's book. They're taking bits and pieces here and there. It didn't bother me because I don't feel the need to have
to persevere.
The perfect timeline of every character as they are in the books.
Okay, so you are to the point where if Chilton was dead after this episode,
it wouldn't
phase you.
No.
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
I was honestly worried that he was going to be dead, and I didn't know how the rest of the story was going to pan out, because it just seemed foreign for him to be dead so soon.
It seemed a little soon.
It's just distressing that Chilton might not have that date with Hannibal Lecter sometime in the future.
Mm.
That dinner date.
Yeah.
because that is where Chilton deserves to end.
You really did not want to be denied. Yeah,
I don't want to be. I want to see that. I want Brian Fuller to give that to me.
Don't take that away.
Because Thomas Harris refused to give that to me. That's not in Hannibal. Brian Fuller.
Please give it to
me. Please,
we need
please
it.
Let me have this.
Yeah, so and everything here, like I said, when I see things that are... According to what I've seen in the books, it's great to experience, and it's great to go, oh wow, yeah, that's like. But there's not enough consistency to the books for me to really care whether or not they're doing the through line. I always find it more interesting of how did they use that character, that scenario, that when you see other little bits and pieces of other characters or victims or things kind of pop up, but they're used like sort of different or completely in a different place. That is really fascinating to me. I'm actually probably more disappointed if the whole thing kept, you know, it never varied from. So I was like, oh, we're taking us someplace different here. I was so into what they were doing. I didn't care. That was the last thing from my mind was, wait a minute, they're fucking with the timeline. They can't do this, man. This is wrong. I was sitting there going, what else is he going to pull out of his abdomen? How much more of this am I going to... And I am not a squeamish person at all. I find this very fascinating. It's knowing that I'm watching network television, that even though I know some of this may not be shown, but I know this whole scene isn't a director's cut.
So a lot of that was all shown.
Yeah,
I mean, really.
I'm
talking when we talk about the producer's cut thing, it's the episodes are the same length. All it is slightly different variance in how long we see a given shot for.
Right.
You know.
So we're seeing a lot of organs being pulled out, the distress.
So I remember seeing the kidney in the original version of
and
it,
and then knowing that they're coming. And the SWAT set up, and then we get to see all
Jack and Will racing to it. Has one of Will's best lines in the episode, where he feels fluid like he's spilling.
And Jack looks at him like, oh my God, you're fucking crazy.
Well, yeah, and Jack is also trying to, it's like, you need to let go of as much of this as you can. You need to leave this at the office, Will. You need to stop this. But I still need you really badly, but you need to leave this all at the office.
It's hard to shake off something that's already under your skin. Right.
Yes,
I liked that. That's the line that stuck out for me.
Jack goes in with SWAT. He grabs his shotgun. He does that thing that I hate in television where he racks the shotgun, which means he just threw a perfectly good shell out on the ground for no reason other than to be a badass.
And made a really loud noise.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, by the way, I'm coming in. Here's the rack.
He looks really badass.
He does.
He's got the bit.
His giant wool coat.
He looks kind of retro.
He does.
Like, you know, you've seen
and this. And he looks massive.
Yeah. He's got the big overcoat and the hat and just... Yeah.
I'm going in. I've got my shotgun.
Exactly.
Here's an extra bullet.
And then he calls the go. He says go. Let everybody... Like, he's calling all the shots.
And he makes Will wait in the car.
Yes.
And did you notice that when Jack is going in, it looks like water on the windshield, and it's not raining, so it's
there are lots of points during the show where there were like little flurries so they're on a snowy road. Everything here, because you know they're shooting in winter. I thought it was interesting too that before they go into this Jack tells Will, you need to take better care of yourself. It's like,
that's Jack being Angrisser. He cares enough to tell Will to be better. He doesn't care enough to help.
Right. Exactly. It seemed like you know, like trying to offer him a band-aid, and he's got
so better care of yourself is just don't come inside.
Right.
We'll take care of it. Come here for no reason.
I know. And then,
I assume he's there in case there's a crime scene.
They want to throw him in.
Then Will can do his pendulum.
Because they're
But take better care.
Yeah.
Take better care of yourself.
Like, we'll call you if we need you.
We have the return of the Raven Stag here.
Yes.
And
Which we haven't seen in a while. Yeah.
And so the Raven Stag calls Will out. So again, it's that helpful element to him. It's come over here.
Yes.
So Will goes over there, and we should probably mention that Jack finds Chilton holding a bundle of his organs.
Yes. With Freddie Lowndes
keeping that, him alive.
Yeah, exactly. Alive. She's got that. And that's her little tableau.
That's...
Like a basket.
A terrifying, intense tableau. Basket. It does. Mm-hmm. It looks like a womb, a pregnancy thing.
He's holding
down there, and they're just piled up in his hand.
And then Freddie's like with that terrified look on her face.
Like, I can't stop squeezing this or he's like, gonna die.
Yeah. But just think, Freddie's got a great story.
That's true. What's also kind of interesting about it is that this is someone who has had no empathy for anyone. And so concerned with the story and her own, internet fame or whatever it is that she's getting out of it, has never had any concern with what she's done and how it's hurt people. And now,
except for that cop who got shot in front of her.
That's there's no way around that one.
Yeah, but few and far between.
She needs it right in front of her face. To panic about it.
So to have then this person whose actions are usually done without any concern with who they hurt, suddenly she's in the position where she has to keep somebody alive.
Mm-hmm. And it's a nice moment for her. Yeah. I mean, it's good character building moment. It builds character. Calvin's dad would be proud.
Yes.
So, you know, like three times in this episode... Eddie Izzard is standing off to the side with his hands in his pockets watching something.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's got like the same expression on his face every time. Just this mild interest. It's like, I don't really care. Whatever.
Whatever.
I'd feel more at home in a dress.
Yeah.
I don't know. Exactly. But so the Ripper's watching, goes to the car, and finds covered in bees.
Sorry.
And Will is in the back seat with a gun.
Yes.
Sweaty and jacked
up.
Shaking like he's gonna just it's just gonna go. I don't know what I'm gonna shoot you.
It's Garrett Jacob Hobbs.
Oh my god.
When he sees Gideon in the rearview mirror,
when this starts popping up.
Will takes him to Hannibal's house, which is interesting. I mean,
He asks, he says, Abel Gideon says, "You don't look well. Who's your doctor?" Who's your doctor?
That's what it is.
And then Will must have given him the directions to Hannibal's house.
We should go there.
Yes, we should go to him. Good idea.
And that whole scene.
Let's go to Hannibal.
Where every time Will looks at Gideon.
And sees Garrett Jacob Hobbs. And then no one.
Yes. Because Hannibal tells him no one is there.
And then no one is there. Yeah. He's
and the whole time Gideon's sitting there like, this is more.
Abel Gideon's like, what the? Like,
anything I've ever done.
I didn't sign up for this.
Yes.
I don't know why I'm here.
Yeah.
Maybe I could just leave.
Exactly.
Maybe
How
about the heartbreaking "Please don't lie to me"?
Yeah. Oh my god! Yeah. Oh my god! That
just
was
before
awful.
The seizure.
Please don't lie to me.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, that's a moment.
Oh, like a
that's
little a, kid. Yeah. Yeah. A little kid.
Yeah. And he's
begging.
It's like, I've trusted you.
Yeah.
And now, in this moment, I seriously doubt my trust in you.
I'm doubting everything you're saying. Why are you lying to me? Don't do this. This is the time I need you to... Then he goes catatonic.
Full on. Right. And Hannibal checks him out, and Gideon's like...
you don't seem very concerned. Because I said it was mild.
He had a seizure. He had a mild seizure. You don't... Yeah. And I love it. He does that wonderful way that Eddie Izzard has. You know, where he's like, well, you don't, you know, I can't even like explain. There's something about his delivery of the line of you don't seem very concerned about your friend.
Eddie Izzard is one of those actors that can perform things in such a unique fashion that even like when he's being serious, he can be funny.
Yeah.
When he's being terrifying, he can be funny. Mm. And there's not a lot of actors who can pull something like that off. And I always feel that Eddie Izzard has a lot in common with like early Tim Curry in that, very much so, from the physicality of his mouth and the motions and the way he performs. I mean, they came up about the same time. They're pretty similar in age, so they're very it's just that quality. Mm. He's got a quality. That's all you can do. That's the only way you can explain.
One thing that I also couldn't stop looking at in this scene were the gigantic ostrich eggs on the basket of raven feathers.
Yes, in the center of the table. I noticed those.
It was so. I'm like, okay, does that mean something? What is that?
It means someone's going to have a really big omelet.
Yeah.
That's what the ostrich eggs mean.
Or it means somebody's going to go into a fire and birth some dragons. I think this winter is incredible.
Winter is here. It's not even coming. Winter is here. You know nothing, Johnson.
Oh, wow.
So Hannibal says it's a terrible thing to have your identity taken from you, which speaks to Chesapeake Ripper, which speaks to Gideon, which speaks to Will.
Even Abigail is confused about who she is.
Everybody has had their identity started to be stripped away.
So when he's sitting there and he says, "You don't seem concerned," his facial features have this communication of curiosity. Like he...
Eddie Izzard?
Yes.
Yeah.
He doesn't really... He doesn't care about Will. I mean,
Will
Abel
is the guy
Gideon,
who just hijacked him.
Right. Yeah. Abel Gideon does not care about the well-being like, of the man who was holding a gun.
That's
at him.
Why I said his delivery of that line
was
so
weird.
Interesting.
It's just sort of weird.
He's like, I want to seem concerned, but I'm just going to sit here and watch this happen because I'm curious as hell as to what's going on here because this is way more interesting than my little identity crisis that I've been dealing with.
Exactly.
Because there is something here.
What the hell
like,
is
what,
going on?
What am I witnessing but, right
isn't
now?
Isn't that when he asks Hannibal if he's the Ripper?
Right.
He does.
And Hannibal doesn't say no.
No.
Doesn't say yes.
Doesn't say no.
But it's like, but he's taking it back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that whole thing.
And that's when Hannibal offers Alana.
Yes.
He does.
But this is another one by psychiatrists. This is another one of those tests. It's like when Hannibal sends Will after Tobias. He expects this to be okay. Because Hannibal really likes Alana.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and wants to protect her and has very flirty feelings.
But he's far more interested in what are they going to do?
Well, I think it was less about setting up Alana than it was setting up Gideon.
Sure. But, I mean, setting up Gideon in a way that could very easily get Alana killed.
Yeah.
Could get Alana killed. And, strangely enough, also, it is... he's totally got this planned out with Will.
Yeah,
he's
setting Will
up. He sets the gun, sets the key.
Yeah.
I'm going to go call Jack now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't take the car. He takes his coat right back off. Yeah, exactly.
Well, that worked out nicely.
And that's why I was like not really concerned. It's like, he knows that Will is going to get there before. Yes, there is a chance.
Test for Will and a test for Alana. Because there's a chance that Will could obviously collapse.
Yeah.
And because not follow through. He just had a seizure.
But he's willing.
What if Will takes the gun and the car, has a seizure while he's driving, and crashes the car, never gets to Gideon? Alana's dead.
Or Alana could prove herself to Hannibal, which is a good point.
Right,
exactly.
But then here we have Gideon in Eddie Izzard watch mode.
Yes, with his hands in his pockets.
Hands in the pockets. Will comes up next to him.
Because he has the gun and he's staggering and I'm waiting for the standoff. And the next thing, they're just standing side by side.
It's a lucid but
and
weird
they're both
Will.
Watching like they're not even aware of each other for a minute or two like
no, it's just like so you and I
and, well, and Gideon, that's when Gideon says I don't know if I'll ever be myself again I don't know if I have any self left over
yes
again that applies to so many people in this and that's when Garrett Jacob Hobbs looks over
oh.
Ah, yeah. And he says, spent so long thinking I was him. And he says, who are you now? I am you. Back to Gideon's conversation with Will.
Well, Garrett Jacob Hobbs' conversation.
Oh, right. Oh.
But he's, when he's Gideon, he's like, we are two people who shouldn't be with other people.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he does.
Which, again, is the married.
Yeah, exactly. And he kind of talks about that. It's like you can't connect with other people because you can't get out of your own head.
And it's interesting that in the very short time that he has had exposure to Will, and this weird, interesting interaction he's just witnessed with Hannibal and Will. Mm. He is starting to see that Will is him, or Will is in the same position that
right.
he and was in. I think Chilton. He feels bad for Will.
He does.
He yeah. sees what Hannibal is doing is to doing, him.
Because yeah. easily, very easily, in that moment, Abel Gideon could have disabled Will, taken the gun away, and killed him.
Yeah.
And then
but he doesn't.
He doesn't.
Instead, he has this whole
He has this kind of, like, compassionate exchange, which is strange.
Yeah. And while he's trying to have this conversation about how we shouldn't be with people again, that's when he turns into
Garrett Jacob Hoffman.
And that's when Will...
I wonder if then you would finally understand what you'd become. Again, the word becoming, which leads to Will shooting Gideon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thinking he's shooting Garrett Jacob Hoffman.
Again.
Yeah.
And so, then we have that long shot through the window.
So there's some interesting stuff that I was writing down when we
This was
back
when we started
to...
pausing the episode a whole
lot. Yes, a whole lot.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
So Hannibal goes to see... Well, he goes...
Jack and Hannibal are drinking scotch.
Yeah, yes. Let's go back to that. So Jack is convinced that Will's going to be okay no matter what. And we find out that...
it's funny how quickly Jack reverts to old Jack.
Yeah.
You know, he's all concerned. Hey, my boy took down Gideon.
Yeah.
He's going
to
be fine.
Even with a temperature of 105, he was still able to bring him down.
Yeah.
And then he even does that dickish... Well, I guess we're just going to have to agree to disagree. We're just going to have a difference of opinion on this doctor.
Yes.
So, I mean, I believe it was Hannibal that gives the information that he had a fever of 105 degrees with two times the amount of white blood cells in his system with no source of the infection. I mean, seriously, this is where Will could potentially die. This is enough to kill a human being. 105? Really?
Yeah.
We don't know how long he's had that fever for 105. I'm surprised he's even lucid. Like, he should be a vegetable. Mm-hmm. He's gonna, like, substantial brain-dead Will.
Well, lucid is a loose description of what's going on with Will.
And, I mean, it's just, like, all of this information is thrown at us, and then we get the irrational Jack. Mm-hmm. Will's gonna be fine.
Yeah.
Like, are you? Yeah. Like, you're just as irrational as unpredictable.
He is clinging to this idea that he has not broken Will. He is desperately clinging to it. And this moment where Will is able to take down the most wanted guy in America, Will's fine. Will's good.
He's not mentally ill.
You know, also, how many of your agents on their best day without 105 fever?
Which
can
could you
do
have
this?
Done it? No, and look how he did it.
Yeah.
I also find it very interesting that when they talk about they don't know what the infection is and everything, it kind of calls back a little bit to Georgia. And that whole idea that, well, they performed all these tests and they can't figure out, you know, and again...
It's about managing expectations.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And then we find out that Chilton is also...
still alive.
We're not, still alive,
but we're not sure how long he's going to survive.
Well, they say if he can survive the night, they're going to have to have surgery all through the night.
Yes.
And he will possibly make it if he can survive the night.
Right.
Basically, if he can stay, if they can keep him alive during all the hours that they need
to reconstruct his entire.
Yeah, well, it's like the jigsaw puzzle. They're starting with the corners.
The corners.
And they're filling in the middle.
Filling it in.
Wow.
I'm sure.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
There's something so morbid about that.
That is true. And we're going back to the totem episode.
The totem pole. Uh huh.
I have written down here in that conversation that someone says our experiences shape us.
Hannibal asks how will this experience shape Will?
Mm-hmm. Like, okay, you think he's going to be fine, but really?
I think this is where
I think Hannibal
sees this is the edge.
Mm-hmm. Where Will has stood on the edge.
And he gets to decide now, do I push him or do I put the fire out?
Mm-hmm. And then we get to hear Hannibal talking about...
I mean, the figurative fire, the actual brain-inducing problems that he's been having biologically are going to be solved because he's now in the hospital.
That's what I figured. They're going to figure it out.
Right. He's going to be regular Will soon. Yeah. If he survives, he's either going to die or he's going to be regular Will.
Apparently,
again.
Because I know there's more episodes.
Yes.
Yeah. What are you trying to play over here? Yeah. So Will might die next episode. I don't know.
Oh man, I can't wait till I watch the next episode to see if he lives.
It's like, you know, in Temple of Doom, what if Indy doesn't make it?
Right, exactly.
Shut up.
That's too much. That's too far. Suggesting that the prequel to Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indy might die. I don't know. That's too far. So, yeah, let's talk about Dr. Demaurier, which is our third returning guest star, the amazing Gillian Anderson. And it's another one, you know. They have such similar vocal back and forth, Dr. Demaurier and Hannibal, where she sees through Hannibal.
Oh, completely.
You know, what value does Will's madness have for you?
Oh, well, yes.
There's a reason why she asks like what value, oil. Because he says, I see his madness. He says, I want to contain it like an oil spill.
Yeah.
And then he's like, well, she's like, oil has value.
Right. And what,
why are you assigning his that value? And that's when she asked, what value do you assign
his and he madness sees himself, to? Yeah, and he could be overdosing on madness.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely. Lovely dialogue. But Will is the opportunity for friendship. Throughout it all, Hannibal still sees, and I don't think he's lying to Dr. Demaurier. I think he really does see that this is the closest he's ever had to a possible friend. Mm-hmm. And he's made it through these trials. It's like he put him into the labyrinth. He's done all these horrific, amazing things, and he's making it through.
Mm-hmm.
So he is more deserving of Hannibal's friendship, as deserving as you can be, of that type of friendship.
Of that type of friendship.
Than anyone else.
When enemies like these.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
But what Dr. Demaurier says is she says, he is your patient. He's not your friend.
He's not your friend.
And you're going to feel the need to step forward to help
whenever
him.
Whenever you do.
And when you do, you need to step back.
You need to step back.
And Hannibal says, and watch Will lose his mind.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, sometimes all we can do is watch.
Is watch.
Yeah, so it makes you wonder, did Dr. Demaurier see Hannibal lose his mind? And sometimes all you can do is watch.
Nothing I can do.
Nothing I can do.
She is a cipher. And she continues to be a cipher. And she's such an interesting one. Because she clearly knows more about Hannibal Lecter than most people know about him. And with that, she's still, if she's afraid of him, okay. But at a certain point, how afraid of him could you be? It's one of those really weird relationships.
It might be where we're seeing like a series of nesting dolls here where each person that is here is fascinated with the madness of the other.
Turtles all the way down.
Right, exactly. Completely. You know, and that where he's sitting there. She's, I think he actually says that where he says, are you suggesting that I'm more fascinated with the madness?
Yeah.
And perhaps that is what's leading all these people to take these very interesting sort of lapses in ethical choices, everyone from Chilton to the neurologist to Lecter to Gideon, and now even in this case, it seems pretty obvious sometimes that she knows exactly who she's dealing with.
Yep.
But is it fascinating
mm-hmm.
to see what this is? Because as a doctor, there's really not much more she can do. If she wants to hold on to the idea that she can't because she doesn't want to break the patient-doctor confidentiality,
mm-hmm.
even though it is a crime.
Yeah.
And you should be...
At that point, you're supposed to.
You're supposed to.
Yeah, you're supposed to.
But is it so fascinating that you can cling on to that idea because she's getting to see this unfold within him and how it works?
Do you get the idea that Dr. Demaurier is agoraphobic?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think she leaves her house?
I've been questioning that just because,
and I don't know why I feel that way, and it's not because of anything else I know about this character. All I know is we see her in that office.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because of that. Because it's got that same feel as Hannibal's office, but darker. It's like she doesn't open her windows often. It's like it's sort of, it feels stuffy. It feels like almost a tomb, to the point where if it was a different show, I'd believe that she is a manifestation of Hannibal's imagination.
True.
Which like is she doesn't have a real world.
Right.
I know that's not the case, so I'm not even going to pretend that's the case.
But I can see
but
that
it feels like that could be a thing. It feels like there isn't more to her character than we've seen. There isn't more to her as a person than this place.
It's a, and it's a viable possibility, because she is a victim of an attack.
Of something that was terrible that happened to her. Yeah. She has one client.
And she doesn't work anymore.
Doesn't see any more clients.
Marcia doesn't see any more clients.
So it's interesting.
So you could see it being justified in that, you know, she is happy to stay home because she had some really terrible stuff happen to her. And only this one interesting client.
One interesting client,
coming back. Who won't leave. Come to her, or won't leave.
Right.
He keeps coming back.
That's true. Honestly, it may not necessarily be that she, you know, she's kind of said almost in a way that Hannibal's kind of got her kidnapped as his psychiatrist.
Well, she does say at the beginning.
She tried to refer you. I tried to get you to succumb, but you won't.
But
so, you know what? I have seen who you are. And I'm not going to mess with you.
Right.
If you want to keep coming to my house to have these conversations about what's going on in Hannibal Land today, I'm just going to roll with it because, you know what? Self-preservation.
That's true,
And Hannibal Land.
And Hannibal Land.
What? An amazing theme park. Hannibal Land.
That
you could have Jane Gum's basement. If you go on the flume ride that takes you into the pit.
Into the pit.
It puts the lotion on its head.
A giant Jane Gum going,
and everyone that leaves the ride is carrying a little lappy dog.
A lappy dog.
And you get your very own stuffed wild boar.
Yeah.
You go visit Mason Verger's farm.
There he goes.
I'm on board with this. Yes. Brian Fuller, you should talk to some people.
Some people.
And put together Hannibal Land.
We need to annex a theme park.
Yeah, find some...
Annex a theme park. We just go in and take over portions of a theme park.
Exactly.
I don't think Disney's on board with this.
Right.
Is it Universal? Maybe.
Universal would probably be...
They might jump in on this. Yeah.
Or the French.
Or the French.
Really, this should be done in France. Or the Japanese would be all over.
Yeah. Oh my God, yeah. But it's got to be a restaurant.
It's like in Disney, you know, instead of the castle, it's a Hannibal themed restaurant that serves gourmet food.
Yes.
Yeah. So that it would be the most expensive theme park ever.
It would.
And it would be terrifying.
It would be terrifying and more money than most people would spend.
But people would go.
Yeah. But people would go.
People would go.
Now, if only they'd watch this show.
Exactly. I want a t-shirt.
So, we've got two episodes
left
in the season.
I want antler hats instead of monkey ears.
Yes! Antler hats!
Yeah. I'm sure you can find antler hats. Actually, we're coming into the holiday season.
Oh my God. Exactly. Antler hats, and it says Hannibal Land.
Oh my God. Yes, instead of Disneyland.
We need to go online.
Get personalized
right away
with our names.
And look for reindeer antler headbands.
There we go.
Because that's
my
it.
My parents
right there.
Never came back from this theme park. All I got from this theme park was a lousy t-shirt.
My parents were rude at
Hannibal Land.
Oh my God.
And all I got was...
I like this. We should send this to Brian Fuller.
Oh,
and
my goodness. We need to write these things down. I know.
I think we've got it covered. We've got it covered.
Okay.
So
sometimes I forget that there's a document of all the things that come out of our mouth.
You can like us on Facebook at facebook.com/eattherootcast. You can follow us on Twitter at eattherootcast. Email us at eattherootcast@gmail.com. And we have a Tumblr, and hopefully by the time this goes up, something will be on it. Ladies, I'm looking at you.
I know you are.
Eattherootcast.tumblr.com.
Maybe there'll be some antler hats.
Yes. Yes,
for sale. Antler hats for sale. Antler hats. We should get that going. Antler hats and the t-shirts.
Yes.
We should do that right away before this airs.
You could do a mug that does like a temperature change thing.
Thanks for joining us at the table.